Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 7th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles: Trump on ballot, justices focus on language in the law, the 14th Amendment at heart of arguments in front of state high court, by Nick Coltrane. Las Vegas, three killed, fourth wounded, gunman dead in UNLV attack, by Ken Ritter and Rio Yamet. Passenger train, rail project to get seed money from Fed program, by John Aguilar. Obituary, Norman Lear, producer of All in the Family, dies at 101, by Lynn Elber, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Trump on ballot, justices focus on language in the law, the 14th Amendment at heart of arguments in front of state high court, by Nick Coltrane, the Denver Post. Colorado Supreme Court justices turned their skeptical eyes toward the case to keep former President Donald Trump off the state's 2024 ballot Wednesday, as they heard arguments over the Republican frontrunner's actions on January 6, 2021, and whether they disqualified him from running again. The seven justices peppered the plaintiffs in the high-profile lawsuit and Trump's legal team with questions, including if the siege of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters constituted an insurrection. They also probed the legal ability of the Colorado Secretary of State to keep candidates off the ballot, the language of the 14th Amendment itself, which says insurrectionists can't run for office, as well as whether Colorado can invoke that rule on its own. The provision at issue in the Civil War-era 14th Amendment was aimed at keeping Confederates away from federal power after the nation reunited. But the language doesn't explicitly bar insurrectionists from the highest office in the land, prompting the Colorado justices to prod both sides about what that means. If it was so important that the president be included, I come back to the question, why not spell it out? Justice Carlos A. Samur, Jr. asked the petitioner's lawyers. Why not include president and vice president in the way they spell out senator or representative? The attorneys hoping to keep Trump off Colorado's ballot had argued that it would be bizarre and counterintuitive to read the amendment as barring rebels from most federal offices while leaving the presidency open to them. Trump's legal team argued the presidency was excluded on purpose as a unique office. But would that mean, Justice Melissa Hart asked, that Jefferson Davis, the former president of the breakaway Confederacy, could have been elected U.S. president after the Civil War? That would be the rule of democracy at work, replied Scott Gessler, a lead attorney for Trump and a former Colorado Secretary of State. The justices will sift through those answers and others in the weeks to come. They have no timeline to issue their ruling, though Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold in January must certify the ballots for the state's March 5th presidential primaries. After the hearing, Gessler said he viewed the justices' close attention to the legal structure of Amendment 14's Section 3 as a positive. That argument is what won for Trump in the lower court. He also didn't want to read too much into their questioning and posture. I think the justices, in one form or another, expressed skepticism of everyone's answers throughout the whole 2 hours, Gessler said. I don't think you can really predict a whole lot from it. In a statement from the plaintiffs afterward, Lakewood attorney Mario Nicolet said, "Our oral argument today speaks for itself. Donald Trump took an oath to support our Constitution as an officer of the United States, violated that oath when he engaged in insurrection, and consequently disqualified himself under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The court's coming ruling could open the case up to a final appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, especially if the justices disqualify Trump. The Colorado ballot case is among several similar ballot qualification lawsuits targeting Trump across the country, but so far all have failed. As it stands, Trump will be on Colorado's Republican ballot. A Denver district judge ruled last month that Trump must be included because the 14th Amendment doesn't apply to presidents. Although Judge Sarah B. Wallace also declared in the findings of fact that Trump engaged in insurrection in January 2021. That ruling prompted an appeal from Trump's legal team and the group of Republican and unaffiliated voters suing to keep him off the ballot. Trump's team agreed with Wallace's reading of the 14th Amendment, but asked the state Supreme Court to strike the declaration that he engaged in insurrection. The petitioners, who are working with the liberal watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, sought a broader ruling, arguing that an insurrectionist can't be allowed to seek the Oval Office. There are similar heavy-hitting cases underway in Minnesota and Michigan, although courts in those states have halted the complaints. Minnesota's Supreme Court did not rule on the merits but said political parties could nominate whomever they liked, leaving open the possibility of a 14th Amendment challenge before the general election there. A Michigan court ruled it would be up to Congress to decide if the amendment bars Trump from the ballot there, and that state's high court declined to expedite its review of the case. The Associated Press contributed to the story. Las Vegas, 3 killed, 4th wounded, gunman dead in UNLV attack. By Ken Ritter and Rio Yamet, The Associated Press, Las Vegas. A gunman killed 3 people and critically wounded a 4th Wednesday at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, before being killed in a shootout with police, authorities said. The attack sent shockwaves through a city still scarred by the deaths of 60 people in a 2017 mass shooting only a few miles away on the famous Strip. Reports of shots fired at about 11:45 a.m. sent police swarming onto the campus while students and professors barricaded themselves inside classrooms and dorm rooms. UNLV Police Chief Adam Garcia said at an evening news conference the campus and local police rushed to the scene. A building housing UNLV's Lee Business School, where 2 university detectives killed the suspect during a shootout. Authorities gave the all-clear about 40 minutes after the first report of a shooting. Sheriff Kevin McMahill said students had gathered outside the building to eat and play games. If police hadn't killed the attacker, it could have been countless additional lives taken, he said. No student should have to fear pursuing their dreams on a college campus, the sheriff said. Authorities didn't immediately release any additional details about the shootings, the victims, the suspect, or a possible motive. Professor Kevin Martin took cover under a desk in her classroom, where another faculty member and 3 students took shelter with her. It was terrifying. I can't even begin to explain, Martin said. I was trying to hold it together for my students and trying not to cry, but the emotions are something I never want to experience again. Martin said she was texting friends and loved ones, hoping to receive word a suspect had been detained. When another professor came to the room and told everyone to evacuate, they joined dozens of others rushing out of the building. Martin had her students pile into her car and drove them off campus. Once we got away from UNLV, we parked and sat in silence, she said. Nobody said a word. We were in utter shock. Students in the community were alerted to the emergency by a university post on X that warned, "This is not a test. Run, hide, fight." The university said the gunman was at the Beam Hall Frank and Estella building, and that police responded to an additional report of shots fired at the nearby student union. Student Matthew Felsenfeld said he and about 12 classmates barricaded their door in a building near the student union. "It's the moment you call your parents and tell them you love them," said Felsenfeld, a 21-year-old journalism student. Jordan Eckerman, 25, said he was in his business law class in a second-floor classroom when he heard a loud bang that he thought came from a neighboring music class. But then a piercing alarm went off, sending students to their feet. Some ran from the room in panic, while others heeded the professor's urging to stay calm, said Eckerman, who walked out and was directed to an exit by a law enforcement officer in a bulletproof vest holding a long gun. UNLV's 332-acre campus is less than 2 miles east of the Strip. It wasn't immediately clear how many of the 30,000 students were on campus. The shooting occurred in a city still scarred by one of the worst mass killings in U.S. history, the October 1, 2017 massacre by a gunman in which 60 people attending a music festival were killed and hundreds more were wounded. The gunman opened fire from a high-rise suite at the Mandalay Bay Casino. The UNLV campus is just more than 3 miles from that location. In response to the campus shootings, the Federal Aviation Administration issued a ground stop of all flights coming into Harry Reid International Airport. The university is 2 miles north of the airport. Classes were canceled through Friday at the university, and UNLV's basketball game at the University of Dayton was canceled Wednesday night because of the attack. Passenger Train, Rail Project to Get Seed Money from Fed Program, by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. The federal government will provide $500,000 in seed money to help kickstart construction of Colorado's Front Range Passenger Rail Project between Fort Collins and Pueblo, a decision that brings the prospect of millions more in future funding. The U.S. Department of Transportation and the Federal Railroad Administration are set to announce that the rail project will be included in the Corridor Identification and Development Program, according to a news release issued Wednesday by U.S. Representative Joe Neguse, a Democrat from Lafayette. The program is a major component of the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law that aims to facilitate the development of intercity passenger rail corridors across the country. Front Range Rail's inclusion could mean significant money from the federal government over the coming years as the project moves closer to reality. Among its chief boosters is Governor Jared Polis. This corridor stretches across more than 160 miles, connecting 13 of the most populous counties across the state and acting as a transportation spine for the Front Range, Neguse said in a statement. I am excited to see this project become a reality for our growing communities. A formal announcement about the money and the corridor plan is expected this week. Before that, members of Congress in several states have publicized other corridors selection too. The infrastructure law contains $66 billion in additional funding for rail, including $1.8 billion for the Corridor ID program, and even more to support federal and state partnerships. This is the first step in identifying projects worthy of funding. The $500,000 from the FRA for Front Range Passenger Rail comes after the project assembled nearly $4 million in funding in late 2021 to pay for studies to gauge the viability of the rail line, including a service plan. Of that total, $1.6 million came from the Colorado Transportation Commission's reserves. Andy Carcian, the general manager of the Front Range Passenger Rail District, a taxing district established to help fund the project, said the Fed's initial $500,000 will go toward the technical work necessary to quantify costs and service for the new corridor. Early estimates have put the cost for a starter system, likely to be operated by Amtrak in a partnership, at $1.7 billion to $2.8 billion, with as many as 6 trains a day running mostly on shared freight tracks connecting cities including Pueblo, Colorado Springs, Denver, and Fort Collins. The first passenger trains between Fort Collins and Pueblo could be rolling within the next decade, Carcian said. Later upgrades to speed up service and add more frequent trains would add billions of dollars to the cost. Karsian said federal officials' selection of the project for the Corridor ID program is significant because it plugs Front Range Rail into a stream of dedicated federal dollars designed to build this project. That's where Colorado is, and that's why we're so excited to be part of the program, he said. Karsian said the district is about halfway through the planning process for the rail line, which it hopes to wrap up by the end of next year. After that, the project will need to move through the all-important environmental clearance process. There's also a politically fraught question of whether and when to ask voters living in the rail district to approve a sales tax to help pay for the project. That's possible as soon as next fall. Polis issued a statement Wednesday lauding Front Range Rail's inclusion in the Federal Rail Corridor Program. Front Range Passenger Rail will modernize our transit system, save people money, and support jobs and housing across our state, he said. I applaud the Department of Transportation and the Biden administration for securing and providing this funding and for recognizing the need for the service and the promise to get it done soon. Obituary. Norman Lear, producer of All in the Family, dies at 101. By Lynn Elber, The Associated Press, Los Angeles. Norman Lear, the writer, director, and producer who revolutionized primetime television with All in the Family, The Jeffersons, and Maude, propelling political and social turmoil into the once insulated world of TV sitcoms, has died. He was 101. Lear died Tuesday night in his sleep, surrounded by family at his home in Los Angeles, said Laura Berchtold, a spokesperson for his family. A liberal activist with an eye for mainstream entertainment, Lear fashioned bold and controversial comedies that were embraced by viewers who had to watch the evening news to find out what was going on in the world. His shows helped define primetime comedy in the 1970s, launched the careers of Rob Reiner and Valerie Bertinelli, and made middle-aged superstars of Carol O'Connor, Bea Arthur, and Red Fox. Lear took television away from dopey wives and dumb fathers, from the pimps, hookers, hustlers, private eyes, junkies, cowboys, and rustlers that constituted television chaos. And in their place, he put the American people, the late Patty Chayefsky, a leading writer of television's early golden age, once said. Tributes poured in after his death. I love Norman Lear with all my heart. He was my second father. Sending my love to Lynn and the whole Lear family, Reiner wrote on X, formerly Twitter. More than anyone before him, Norman used situation comedy to shine a light on prejudice, intolerance, and inequality. He created families that mirrored ours, Jimmy Kimmel said. All in the Family was immersed in the headlines of the day, while also drawing upon Lear's childhood memories of his tempestuous father. Racism, feminism, and the Vietnam War were flashpoints as blue-collar conservative Archie Bunker, played by O'Connor, clashed with liberal son-in-law Mike Stivic, Reiner. Jean Stapleton co-starred as Archie's befuddled but good-hearted wife, Edith, and Sally Struthers played the Bunker's daughter, Gloria, who defended her husband in arguments with Archie. Lear's work transformed television at a time when old-fashioned programs such as Here's Lucy, Ironside, and Gunsmoke still dominated. CBS, Lear's primary network, soon would enact its rural purge and cancel such standbys as The Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres. The groundbreaking sitcom The Mary Tyler Moore Show, about a single career woman in Minneapolis, debuted on CBS in September 1970, just months before All in the Family started. But ABC passed on All in the Family twice, and CBS ran a disclaimer when it finally aired the show. The program you are about to see is All in the Family. It seeks to throw a humorous spotlight on our frailties, prejudices, and concerns. By making them a source of laughter, we hope to show, in a mature fashion, just how absurd they are. By the end of 1971, All in the Family was number one in the ratings, and Archie Bunker was a pop culture fixture, with President Richard Nixon among his fans. Some of his put-downs became catchphrases. He called his son-in-law Meathead and his wife Dingbat, and he would snap at anyone who dared occupy his faded chair. It was the centerpiece of the Bunker's row house in Queens, and it eventually went on display in the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Even the show's opening segment was innovative. Instead of an off-screen theme song, Archie and Edith are seated at the piano in their living room, belting out a nostalgic number, "Those Were the Days," with Edith screaming off-key and Archie crooning such lines as, "Didn't need no welfare state," and "Girls were girls and men were men." All in the Family, based on the British sitcom Till Death Us Do Part, was the number one rated series for an unprecedented 5 years in a row and earned 4 Emmy Awards as Best Comedy Series, finally eclipsed by 5-time winner Frasier in 1998. Hits continued for Lear and then partner Bud Yorkin, including Maude and the Jeffersons, both spinoffs from All in the Family. With the same winning combination of one-liners and social conflict, in a 1972 two-part episode of Maude, the title character, played by Arthur, became the first on television to have an abortion, drawing a surge of protests along with high ratings. And when a close friend of Archie's turned out to be gay, Nixon privately fumed to White House aides that the show glorified same-sex relationships. Controversy suggests people are thinking about something, but they're better be laughing first and foremost, or it's a dog, Lear said in a 1994 interview with the Associated Press. Lear and Yorkin also created Good Times, about a working-class black family in Chicago. Sanford and Son is showcased for Fox as junkyard dealer Fred Sanford, and One Day at a Time, starring Bonnie Franklin as a single mother and Bertinelli and Mackenzie Phillips as her daughters. In the 1974-75 season, Lear and Yorkin produced 5 of the top 10 shows. Lear's business success enabled him to express his ardent political beliefs beyond the small screen. In 2000, he and a partner bought a copy of the Declaration of Independence for $8.14 million and sent it on a cross-country tour. He was an active donor to Democratic candidates and founded the nonprofit advocacy group People for the American Way in 1980. He said because people such as evangelist Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson were abusing religion. "I started to say, this is not my America. You don't mix politics and religion this way," Lear said in a 1992 interview with Commonweal magazine. The nonprofit's president, Svante Marek, said, "We are heartbroken by Lear's death. We extend our deepest sympathies to Norman's wife, Lynn, and their entire family, and to the many people who, like us, love Norman." With his wry smile and impish boat hat, the youthful Lear created television well into his 90s, rebooting One Day at a Time for Netflix in 2017, and exploring income inequality for the documentary series America Divided in 2016. Documentarians featured him in 2016's Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You, and 2017's If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast, a look at active nonagenarians such as Lear and Rob Reiner's father, Carl Reiner. In 1984, he was lauded as the innovative writer who brought realism to television when he became one of the first 7 people inducted into the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. He later received a National Medal of Arts and was honored at the Kennedy Center. In 2020, he won an Emmy as executive producer of Live in Front of a Studio Audience, All in the Family, and Good Times. Lear beat the tough TV odds to an astounding degree. At least one of his shows placed him prime time's top 10 for 11 consecutive years, 1971-82. But Lear had flops as well. Shows including Hotel Baltimore, Palmerstown, and AKA Pablo, a rare Latino series, drew critical favor but couldn't find an audience. Others, such as All That Glitters and The Nancy Walker Show, earned neither. He also faced resistance from cast members, including Good Time stars John Amos and Esther Roll, who often objected to the scripts as racially insensitive, and endured a mid-season walkout by Fox, who missed 8 episodes in 1973-74 because of a contract dispute. In the 1990s, the comedy 704 Houser, which returned to the Bunker House with a new family, and the political satire The Powers That Be were short-lived. Lear's business moves, meanwhile, were almost consistently fruitful. Lear started TAT Communications in 1974 to be sole creative captain of his ship. His former business partner, Jerry Parenchio, told the Los Angeles Times in 1990, "The company became a major TV producer with shows including One Day at a Time and the soap opera spoof Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, which Lear distributed himself after it was rejected by the networks." In 1982, Lear and Parenchio bought Avco Embassy Pictures and formed Embassy Communications as TAT's successor, becoming successfully involved in movies, home video, pay TV, and cable ownership. In 1985, Lear and Parenchio sold Embassy to Coca-Cola for $485 million. They had sold their cable holdings the year before, reportedly for a hefty profit. By 1986, Lear was on Forbes magazine's list of the 400 richest people in America, with an estimated net worth of $225 million. He didn't make the cut the next year after a $112 million divorce settlement for his second wife, Frances. They had been married 29 years and had 2 daughters. He married his third wife, psychologist Lynn Davis, in 1987, and the couple had 3 children. Frances Lear, who went on to found Lear's Magazine in her settlement, died in 1996 at age 73. Lear was born in New Haven, Connecticut on July 27, 1922, to Herman Lear, a securities broker who served time in prison for selling fake bonds, and Jeanette, a homemaker who helped inspire Edith Bunker. Like a sitcom, his family life was full of quirks and grudges, a group of people living at the ends of their nerves and the tops of their lungs, he said during a 2004 appearance at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston. Elijah McClain, paramedics told investigators man had excited delirium, condition rejected by some doctors' groups. Police officers won't be trained to look for it, by Colleen Slevin, the Associated Press. 2 paramedics on trial over the 2019 death of Elijah McClain told investigators in videotaped interviews previously unseen by the public that the 23-year-old black man had excited delirium, a disputed condition some say is unscientific and rooted in racism. McClain died after being stopped by police while walking home from a convenience store, then forcibly restrained and injected with ketamine by the paramedics in Aurora. Initially, no one was charged because the coroner's office could not determine how McClain died, but social justice protests over the 2020 murder of George Floyd drew renewed attention to McClain's case, which led to the 2021 indictment of the paramedics and 3 officers. Starting in 2018, paramedics in Aurora were trained to use ketamine, a sedative, to treat excited delirium after approval from state regulators. Under their training, if they determined that an agitated person they were treating had the condition, which has been described as involving bizarre behavior and a high tolerance for pain, they were told to administer ketamine. However, critics say such diagnoses have been misused to justify excessive force against suspects. It's been rejected by some doctors' groups in the years since McClain's fatal stop. And last week, Colorado officials decided that police officers will no longer be trained to look for the condition starting in 2024. Previously, Colorado told paramedics to stop using excited delirium as a basis for administering ketamine. Aurora Fire Department paramedics Jeremy Cooper and Peter Sechuniak told detectives in separate 2019 interviews that prosecutors showed to jurors Wednesday that McLean was actively resisting officers. They said McLean showed unusual strength, a supposed symptom of excited delirium. Cooper alleged McLean tried to get away from the officers, at one point attempting to walk up a grassy area outside an apartment building where he was being held by police. The claim is at odds with body camera footage that shows McLean handcuffed and pinned to the ground by officers before Cooper injected him with ketamine. McLean cannot always be seen in the footage, but no attempt to get away was mentioned at the previous trials of the three police officers. Sechuniak, the senior officer of the medical crew, said it was his decision to give McLean ketamine and that it was the first time he was involved with administering it. He said they were dispatched to help because of a report that a man had been running around in a mask, not making sense, and waving his arms at people. If you looked in his eyes, no one was home, he said in the interview. The first comments from the paramedics to be made public since they were charged. The fatal encounter on August 24, 2019, began when a 911 caller reported that a man looked sketchy as he walked down the street wearing a ski mask and raising his hands in the air. However, it now appears that McLean, who was headed home after buying some iced tea, was moving to the music he later told police he was listening to. Prosecutors say surveillance video of him leaving the store shows him dancing as he walked through the parking lot. During previous trials, two of the officers who confronted McLean were acquitted. The third officer was convicted of negligent homicide and third-degree assault. The trial is scheduled to continue through most of December, exploring largely uncharted legal territory because it is rare for medical first responders to face criminal charges. However, health concerns could delay proceedings. It was revealed Wednesday that one juror tested positive for COVID-19 using an expired at-home test. The judge planned to ask him to take another test and talk to jurors Thursday about the results before deciding how to proceed. Cannabis. Sleep supplement maker facing claims. 1906's Midnight Drops contain herb linked to liver problems, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. A maker of cannabis and herb supplements in Adams County recently settled one lawsuit and faces other claims after some people who took its marijuana-infused sleep aids said they developed sudden liver problems. Bailey Pate, a 36-year-old resident of the Denver area, sued Sima Sciences and Nuka Enterprises, both based in Henderson. She alleged that their Midnight sleep aid drops cause liver damage after she used them for about 16 months in 2020 and 2021. She settled with the companies this week for an undisclosed amount. Laura Brown, an attorney who represented Pate, said thousands of people in Colorado and a handful of other states may have claims, either for injuries they suffered or for the money they spent on a potentially unsafe product. The drops, sold under the 1906 brand name, included cannabis and corydalus, a traditional Chinese herbal remedy. Corydalus contains tetrahydropalmitine, or THP, a chemical that can cause liver damage at high doses. The manufacturers recalled the products this year. Peter Barsoom, the CEO of Nuka Enterprises, told the Denver Post in a statement Wednesday that the company received a small number of reports from customers who experienced a rare side effect, elevated liver enzymes, from the drops in their latest formulation. In every case we are aware of, levels went back to normal after discontinuing use, he wrote. While thousands use Midnight every night without any side effects, we take our responsibility seriously and discontinued Midnight earlier this year. We deeply regret the suffering that some customers experienced. In July 2022, the Marijuana Enforcement Division and the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment issued a warning that said the products could cause liver injury. The drops remained available for sale, however, because the manufacturers said they had replaced corydalus with stephania, another herb. Another state announcement in June said the manufacturers were working to remove the drops from store shelves after reports of liver injuries from the Stefania version. The Marijuana Enforcement Division routinely accepts complaints about harm from marijuana products, investigating them with the state health department if the alleged health consequences are serious. Evan Hoffman, a Denver lawyer, said he represents about 30 people who developed liver problems after using the drops. About half of his clients were hospitalized, usually between 2 and 8 days, after developing jaundice, nausea, and unexplained fatigue, he said. His clients are in settlement talks with the company, and some others have reached their own settlements, Hoffman said. He estimated 2 to 4 people still reach out to him in a typical week as they realize what could have caused their sudden liver problems, he said. People are still just now putting the pieces together, he said. Hoffman said his clients are not only upset about the unknown health consequences of their liver damage, but angry that the company seemed to know it was a possibility and didn't warn them. They didn't do anything about it because it was their best-selling product, he said. As of late November, the manufacturers were selling 6 other products under the 1906 label. Visitors to the site could click on a list of ingredients, but the only warnings stated that customers should consult their doctors about any dietary supplements and that pregnant and breastfeeding women shouldn't take these products. Online searches for the ingredients turned up some that were linked to kidney damage and liver failure. Others could worsen autoimmune diseases or interfere with medications. Plant-based remedies generally aren't studied extensively, however, so it's not clear if the amount of herbs in the supplements could be dangerous. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration doesn't regulate supplements unless they state the product can treat, prevent, diagnose, or cure a specific condition. That's why so many products make nebulous claims, such as that they boost immunity. Brown said the absence of meaningful regulation means that you really need to take it upon yourself to investigate the ingredients as much as you can. She added, but consumers shouldn't have that put on them. In brief, paraglider hurt in crash on Wednesday afternoon. A man is in critical condition after crashing his paraglider in North Boulder on Wednesday afternoon. The crash occurred about 2 p.m. in the area of 6th Street and Locust Avenue. A crew from Boulder Fire Rescue found the injured man 2/3 of the way up Wonderland Hill. Emergency crews were able to transport the man down the hill. He was then taken by ambulance to Boulder Community Health's Foothills Hospital. Officials said the paraglider sustained injuries to his right side and was in critical condition. This brief was by Mitchell Byers, Daily Camera. Body of missing kayaker found in Lake Granby. Emergency responders found the body of a 21-year-old Denver area man Monday night who went underwater while kayaking on Lake Granby on Sunday morning, Grand County officials said. The body was placed in the care of the coroner's office, which has been in contact with his family. About 6:45 a.m. Sunday, the sheriff's office, along with medical and fire teams, Colorado Parks and Wildlife personnel, and staffers from the Beacon Landing Marina at Lake Granby, responded to a report of a man who needed help in the water near Deer Island, according to a news release from the sheriff's office. The man spent the night on Deer Island with a friend, and the two were attempting to kayak back to shore Sunday when the wind caused his boat to capsize, the news release stated. The friend was unable to save him before he went underwater, but the friend made it back to shore and called emergency services, according to the release. The area's snowfall and low visibility made it difficult for crews to reach the area Sunday, the news release stated. Additional searches resumed Monday. This brief was by Lauren Pennington, the Denver Post. Denver, lawsuit, extortion demand stopped $60 million sale of off-site DIA parking by Justin Wingerter, Business Den. The halted sale of a $60 million parking lot near Denver International Airport has led two of the lot's co-owners to accuse a third co-owner of extortion. U.S. Airport Parking, west of the airport at 18,000 East 81st Avenue in Commerce City, first opened in 1998. Its shuttle lot offers covered and uncovered parking, along with oil changes. In January, Green Court Partners, a Chicago company that owns the parking spot chain, offered to buy U.S. airport parking for $57 million, according to a November 20th lawsuit. William Barber, a co-owner and manager of U.S. airport parking, asked for $60 million instead, and Green Court agreed to pay $60 million in August, the lawsuit claims. The ownership structure of U.S. airport parking is layered and complex, with five LLCs splitting control. As the owner of one LLC and manager of two others, Barber is able to exercise almost complete control over the business organization, despite owning just 25.5% of U.S. airport parking, according to his business partners, who own the other 74.5%. When it came time to sell to Green Court, Barber made what the other co-owners now call his extortion demand, $6 million off the top before sale proceeds could be divvied up. Barber's business partners, Milton Rotenberg and Timothy Marischula, rejected that demand, so Barber has blocked the $60 million sale ever since, according to the November 20th lawsuit. As a result of this corporate structure, the owner of 25.5% of the business organization is able to preclude the sale of the assets at an extremely favorable price, it states. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit, which are the LLCs that Rotenberg and Marischula control, also accused Barber of employing his family members at salaries excessive for the tasks they perform, and allege that a disability has left him unable to make sound decisions. Barber's refusal to act upon the $60 million offer is for purposes of keeping his family members employed, because the sale of assets to the bona fide officer would result in the termination of his family members from their current employment, they claim. The plaintiffs are asking Douglas County District Court Judge Jerry Kramer to remove Barber as manager of the two LLCs he runs and also dissolve one of the companies. Doing so would break a deadlock and allow for the sale of U.S. airport parking to Green Court. Barber has not been served the lawsuit yet and has not had a chance to respond in court. Shelley Barber, his daughter, and the chief operations officer at U.S. Airport Parking initially agreed to discuss the case with Business Den, but later declined to comment. The plaintiffs are represented by attorneys John Hutchings and Patrick Tooley, with Dill Carr, Stonebreaker, and Hutchins, a Denver firm. I-70, CDOT wraps up project between Frisco, Silverthorne, by Ryan Spencer, Summit Daily. The Colorado Department of Transportation has completed its Interstate 70 Auxiliary Lane project between Frisco and Silverthorne, aimed at improving safety on a critical highway artery for Summit County residents, visitors, and through traffic. After two summers of minor road impacts related to the project, Colorado Department of Transportation Executive Director Shoshana Liu said Tuesday that crews have wrapped up work on the project. This is anticipated to reduce crashes, help people move around each other in rough conditions, make it easier for freight traffic, single occupancy vehicles, buses, everyone, Liu said. This area, as we all know, experiences very high volumes of traffic, particularly on the weekends, and in the winter we're navigating weather conditions as we just saw over the weekend. With construction costs totaling around $24 million, the I-70 Auxiliary Lane project included the construction of an additional lane along approximately 3.5 miles of eastbound I-70 between Frisco and Silverthorne, according to the Transportation Department. The project also included structural work to widen two eastbound bridges over the Blue River and US 6, installation of wildlife fencing along both eastbound and westbound I-70, and a longer deceleration lane at exit 205 in Silverthorne. CDOT Region 3 Transportation Director Jason Smith said the area where wildlife fencing was installed had previously seen 38 vehicle-animal crashes over a five-year span. The Transportation Department hopes the fencing will result in an 80% drop in such crashes, Smith said. Less noticeable parts of the auxiliary lane project included drainage improvements and additional commercial and passenger vehicle parking at the scenic overlook on eastbound I-70, he added. The Colorado Department of Transportation also recently added sidewalks near US 6 and Colorado 9, as well as reconfigured traffic signal timing along that stretch of road in Dillon and Silverthorne, resulting in a 15% faster timing, Smith said. Overall, the auxiliary lane project resulted in minimal traffic impacts throughout its construction and wrapped up in October, earlier than originally planned, he said. Federal Highway Administration Division Administrator John Cater noted significant safety improvements associated with the project. The project should reduce backups at both the exit 205 interchange and the exit 203 interchange, Cater said. From 2009 to 2014, Colorado had about 400 traffic-related fatalities a year, but that has grown dramatically to about 760 such fatalities in the state last year, or about two people dying on the road each day, he said. That's horrific, Cater said. That's something we have to do something about, and this project is one of the many things we're doing statewide to help address that. Colorado House Speaker Julie McCluskey called the auxiliary lane project a desperately needed and improved safety feature along I-70 and noted for the almost 90,000 constituents in her district, which includes Summit County, transportation and road safety are a top topic. McCluskey pointed to I-70's important role in the Colorado state economy, as well as for local travelers who live in the community and rely on the interstate to go about their everyday lives. We know that this is better for everyone who's on the road, McCluskey said. I-70 is a critical part of the infrastructure to the Western Slope economy. We know we need to keep this road open, and this particular space makes that possible. The I-70 auxiliary lane project between Frisco and Silverthorne was part of a Colorado Department of Transportation 10-year plan for the area. With the conclusion of the project, the Transportation Department has started to look ahead to the next project in line, the Frisco Exit 203 Interchange Project. The Colorado Department of Transportation held an open house last month in Frisco to solicit public input on the Exit 203 project, which could reportedly get underway as soon as spring 2025 or summer 2026. The Exit 203 project will focus on safety, mobility, and operational improvements to the I-70 interchange with Colorado 9 and an adjacent intersection with Dillon Dam Road, according to the Transportation Department. One of the main goals reportedly is to alleviate dangerous backups at westbound Exit 203. Boulder County, woman accused of forging COVID documents pleads guilty, by Nikki Andrews, Daily Camera. A former immigration attorney accused of forging COVID documents to avoid appearing in person during a separate court case took a plea deal Monday and was sentenced to 2 years of probation. Emily Cohen, 44, pleaded guilty on Monday to one count of forgery, commercial instrument, a Class 5 felony. All other charges were dismissed, including three counts of attempt to influence a public servant and one count of forgery, check, or commercial instrument. Cohen was originally scheduled for a trial starting Monday, but that was canceled as a result of the plea. She was also ordered to complete 80 hours of useful public service, according to Boulder County District Attorney's Office spokeswoman Shannon Carboni. In an email, District Attorney Michael Doherty said the plea and felony conviction show that Cohen tried to use the pandemic to serve her own purposes. With today's guilty plea, Emily Cohen admitted to providing fraudulent documents to the court, Doherty said in an email. I appreciate the hard work of the DA investigators and prosecutors who were skeptical of her representations to the court. Their skepticism was well-founded, as demonstrated by today's guilty plea, and they conducted a thorough investigation into this fraudulent conduct by Ms. Cohen. Cohen was originally found guilty on 13 of 21 theft counts following a 2014 trial after prosecutors said she collected more than $41,000 in combined fees from seven immigrant families, then dropped out of contact without producing the visas and work permits she had promised her clients. The Colorado Court of Appeals overturned the convictions in 2018, and Cohen accepted a new plea deal rather than go through with a retrial on 11 theft counts. But while that case was pending, Cohen failed to appear in person for a pretrial conference on November 2, 2021, instead appearing virtually after filing a motion saying she had tested positive for the coronavirus in Iowa. The judge in the case had issued a ruling ordering Cohen to appear in person unless she could produce a positive test result following at least one other instance in which she failed to appear for an in-person hearing while claiming she had COVID-19. Prosecutors said Cohen had previously submitted letters from a University of Iowa clinic in July 2022 claiming she had COVID symptoms. And Cohen again produced a letter in November 2022 from a doctor saying she had tested positive. Former Speaker of the House, McCarthy will leave Congress by year's end, by Michael R. Blood and Kevin Freiking, the Associated Press, Los Angeles. 2 months after his historic ouster as U.S. House Speaker, Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy said Wednesday he is resigning and will leave Congress by the end of the year. His announcement capped a stunning end to a House career for the one-time deli counter owner from Bakersfield, California, who ascended through state and national politics to become second in line to the presidency until a cluster of hard-right conservatives engineered his removal in October. McCarthy is the only speaker in history to be voted out of the job. "No matter the odds or personal costs, we did the right thing," McCarthy wrote in the Wall Street Journal, announcing his decision. "It is in this spirit that I have decided to depart the House at the end of this year to serve America in new ways." Word about McCarthy's future had been expected days before the filing deadline to seek re-election to the House. But his decision ricocheted across Capitol Hill, where his departure will leave the paper-thin House Republican majority even tighter, with just a few seats to spare. It adds to the wave of retirements in the House, which has been split by Republican infighting, and the rare expulsion last week of indicted GOP Representative George Santos of New York, dashing hopes for major accomplishments and leaving the majority straining to conduct the basic business of governing. It's also the end of an era for a generation of House Republicans led by McCarthy and former Representatives Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor, the so-called Young Guns, whose book of the same title outlined a new style of GOP governance. Ryan and Cantor are gone, and McCarthy will exit soon. McCarthy had brought the Republicans into the majority, but found it was much more difficult to lead the GOP's factions. His toppling from the Speaker's post was fueled by grievances from his party's hard right flank, including over his decision to work with Democrats to keep the federal government open rather than risk a shutdown. House Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana, a Republican who succeeded McCarthy as Speaker, tweeted that McCarthy served faithfully and sacrificed substantially for the good of our country and our cause. Speaking later with reporters, Johnson called McCarthy a long and trusted friend and said he was sad to see him go. Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican Florida, who led the effort to remove McCarthy, tweeted a one-word response after his announcement, "McLeaven." In brief, from the New York Times, "Time Magazine named Swift its Person of the Year. Time Magazine on Wednesday named Taylor Swift as its Person of the Year. Picking one person who represents the 8 billion people on the planet is no easy task. We picked a choice that represents joy, someone who's bringing light to the world," said Sam Jacobs, the magazine's editor-in-chief, on NBC's Today program on Wednesday morning. "She was like weather. She was everywhere." Swift beat out 8 other finalists who were announced on Today this week, including King Charles III and Barbie. Swift's accomplishments as an artist, culturally, critically, and commercially, are so legion that to recount them seems almost beside the point, the magazine wrote. Swift grabbed many headlines in 2023, in part spurred by her immensely popular Eras Tour that proved too much for Ticketmaster to handle, the release of the re-recording of her 2014 album 1989 that broke sales records, and her relationship with Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. Swift has also become a subject of academic and even more journalistic interest. Harvard University will offer a Taylor Swift and Her World class, and Gannett, the largest newspaper chain in the United States, appointed a special reporter to cover nothing but Swift. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.